Thanks, Dan. Is my mic on? Yes, sounds like it's on. Good, good. Yeah, so I guess I owe you an explanation on why I'm talking about such a weird little topic. I think I hope you'll find that it's a little mathematically cute, and at the end I'm going to make some extravagant claims for why it might be biologically relevant. But the real story is that in the years we lived in Los Alamos, my wife became a great outdoors person and hiker, and ever since that time, every weekend, she says to me, let's go out and walk 5 miles. And the only way I can avoid that is by saying, oh, I have some work I have to do. And that includes just manufacturing projects that I had never thought about before. And one of them that had just been on my mind for a long time, you know, decades probably, was what's really going on in that prisoner's dilemma little game stuff. And so this was the way I avoided some healthy weekend hike. And then it turned into a real project, as you'll see, or something worth talking about, I hope, as you'll see. So the prisoner's dilemma game, I hope you've heard of before, and it's just one of these little game things that game theorists love, these little 2x2 tables. So we have two players, X, who is conveniently drawn as female, and Y, conveniently drawn as male. That's because of their chromosomes. And each can decide on, we're going to show a single play of this game. So Y decides whether to play C or D, this column or this column, and X decides also to play whether C, this row, or D, and then the numbers show the reward that each receives, okay? Turns out C stands for cooperate and D stands for defect, but at this level we haven't seen why that might be true. And the way it works is if they both cooperate, then they both get 3. Or in the more general case, some reward R, okay? If they both defect, they both get 1. So you would think that naturally each would try to cooperate. However, if X cooperates and Y defects, then X gets punished and Y gets an even bigger reward. And correspondingly, it's exactly symmetrical. If Y cooperates and X defects, then Y gets the bigger reward. So it's the nature of the way those numbers are set up that mutual cooperation is a pretty good outcome, but each one can do better by defecting independent of the other one's choice. See, that's the important point, that Y goes from 3 to 5 by moving across here and goes from 0 to 1 from moving across here. So there's never any reason for Y to do anything except defect independent of X's output and symmetrically the other way around. So the Nash equilibrium is mutual defection, and they both end up with P, the punishment score of 1, okay? And game theorists love this because it just somehow seems unfair that cooperation doesn't pay when it's been set up like this. Biologists love this because a certain school of biologists, evolution theory biologists, love this because I think the reason it seems unfair to us is that we see signs of cooperation all around us in the real world. And it's clear that cooperation in situations that could be prisoner's dilemma-like somehow evolves to end up not always but often in the cooperation side. So how does that come out? And it's still, I think, an enduring mystery in evolutionary biology. There's a set of not very satisfactory answers, but I would put it still in the mystery category. Why is cooperation so widely prevalent in real life when it's very hard to make models in which it dominates? Okay, so we'll get to some of that. But the interesting part now is if the players play not just once, but an indefinite number of times, and that's called iterated prisoner's dilemma, or IPD. So the picture here is there's some whole set of past iterations of the game, and what we're trying to decide on this iteration is how should we play on this iteration? And the players are allowed now to have a memory of the past. Well, you could say they have an infinite memory, but that's a rather intractable problem, although as I'll show you in a second, it isn't really. So here I've just illustrated an example where Y has memory 7. Y gets to remember the last 7 moves, but X, for example, has only memory 2, gets to remember the last 2 moves. And Again, what's the hope here? The hope is, well, since we can see past moves, maybe we'll learn to cooperate. Maybe each player will try a cooperation, and then it won't work, but then the other will have seen that they tried to cooperate, so the other one will say, hey, chances are good that if I cooperate, we can both get three, okay? And somehow, there'll be strategies that develop from memory that lead to cooperation. So same players, and each gets to evolve a strategy. Do they usually achieve cooperation? And the answer is a resounding no. And people have studied many versions of this for now 30 years, as it says here. So this became a sort of a popular topic of speculation in probably the early 1980s, and there are hundreds of papers written about this, and with every possible permutation on it. Add noise to the decision process, add third parties, you can imagine. And there's still an active literature. It's mostly moved into the economics literature rather than the biology or evolution theory literature. Now, when I started thinking about this, one thing that I noticed right away, and I couldn't believe that I was discovering this for the first time, but it turns out to be one of these folklore facts that nobody can point to it in a book, but everybody in the field actually knows it. Okay, so, but it's a little odd. And the fact is, it's the short memory player who sets the rules of the game in this, and not just in Prisoner's Dilemma, but in any of these 2x2 games. That is to say, you might have thought it was like, I don't know, bridge, where if I'm a bad bridge player and I can only remember the last three hands, not hands, what do we call those things? Tricks. I'm not a bridge player. Then I'm at a severe disadvantage to a longer memory player who can remember the cards farther back, okay? But these little 2x2 games are not like that because each play is anew. And you can do this little calculation of just saying, if I condition the current play on some recent history, H0, and some older history, H1, then what's the probability of some outcome? X and Y are random variables, so X is equal to either C or D, and Y is equal to either C or D. Okay, and let's compute away. I won't take you all through this too much, but I want to give you the idea. So we want an expectation over the history. So here's the sum over histories of the probability of that history of something. And now the key point is the joint probability of an X and Y is the product of two independent probabilities because the players make independent plays, but X is conditioned only on H0, whereas Y's is conditioned on both the recent history and the old history, H0, H1. Okay, well this immediately lets you do things like the sum over H0 can be moved in through this term and you can write this. And you know, you apply the standard little laws of probability, and this is where this folklore, but to me still amazing thing drops out. The way to see it right here is that Y's strategy enters, but only marginalized over H1. In other words, Y's strategy doesn't actually depend on H1, even though Y thought it did. Or another way of saying that is, for any long history that Y thinks he's playing, there's an equivalent short history that would produce a short history strategy that would produce exactly the same probability distribution of outcomes on each play. Okay, so Y could fool himself and say, oh, I'm looking 10 moves back, but in the end, the strategy, basically because X doesn't care. Another way of saying this is, in the end, Y's older history is just some crazy random number generator that he's using that X doesn't care about because X is just not conditioned on that. Okay, so that's kind of fun. And that means that the problem has a reduction that's very, very tractable. If we think only about how X should play and X plays a memory one strategy, then that's the whole game. The game is a memory one game. Okay. So now we're going to just concentrate on this little toy subset, which we see has enough generality to it. Namely, there's a previous move, and it ended up in one of the four quadrants, okay? And then this is the current move, And let's see, x is blue. So x basically has a probability associated with each quadrant of cooperating. So with probability P1, if the previous move was here, x will determine that we're going to be in this row. And then y's probabilities, you see, go in to determine which column we're in. And thereby, the game advances. So you see that a complete description of x's and y's strategy is a little eight-dimensional hypercube, because each of them gets to pick four probabilities between 0 and 1. Okay, and so instantaneously, the game is a point inside this 8 cube. And if we want to think about evolution of strategies, the way we should do that is we should think about that point moving around inside the 8 cube, okay, as they over a longer time scale. There's a sort of a two-time scale thing. There's what do they do move by move, and how do they evolve their strategies on a long time scale? Maybe not continuously, maybe jumping around in that 8 cube. The other thing you see is this is now a nice Markov process, because basically there's a transition matrix that depends on these P's and Q's, depends on the position in this 8 space, that says if you're in a certain quadrant on one move, what's their probability of ending up in a certain quadrant on the other move? And if you work out the products of these P's and Q's and the rows and columns, you get this little Markov matrix. Okay. So that's also a nice simplification, because we now don't have to simulate this if we want to see what games look like. We don't have to simulate them move by move. We can do our simulations only on the long time scale. You tell me where we are in this hypercube, and I'll tell you what the expectation values of the scores will be. And then if either side wants to move, right, x is allowed to move the p's and y is allowed to move the q's, and then we can see how the game proceeds. So with this kind of an evolutionary interest in this, we can ask, what if each player, what if we just sort of plop down that point into the hypercube somewhere and then let each player try to do what dumb Darwinian evolution says they should do? Each one, of course, in real life, it would be a whole bunch of organisms representing a species, but basically each species gets to experiment with moving their point around a little bit and seeing if their reward goes up. So basically, it's hill climbing. Well, it turns out the population geneticists understand that evolution isn't exactly hill climbing, because you have this distribution of strategies in a population at any time. I'm going to gloss over that. The differences are subtle, and show you just some little computer simulations that kept me from having to do the 5-mile forest march that weekend. So we'll start at fully non-cooperative, and I'm just making up the rules here. I'm going to alternate evolutionary moves between x and y. And in each case, each player will sample a little four-dimensional neighborhood, because those are the four parameters they can control, and just move uphill. Okay. And it's going to turn out to be important that there are directions that are exactly neutral, that in this eight-dimensional space, there are subspaces in which your score doesn't change if you move on them. Okay. I'm going to give you more insight into that a little bit later. But if you actually program this, you have to decide what to do in those cases, okay? If you decide that when it's exactly neutral, they don't move at all, then you just quickly end up in a place, actually you never get out of non-cooperation, because it's best for them both to just stay non-cooperating. So instead what I did was, each time I ran this, I took a tiny little bias, which you could imagine in biology is saying that although each species is trying to find the uphill direction, this isn't the only game they're playing, right? They're also trying to avoid being eaten by saber-toothed tigers or forage for food or something. And that would introduce slight biases into their survival over and above the question of whether they cooperate with in this part of their life. And the question is, if we do this evolution, does it terminate at a Nash equilibrium? Are there any interesting equilibria of this other than the single play obvious answer of never cooperate? So here's a typical evolution, but you'll see typical is a funny word here, where This is score, and remember, one is not cooperate, and three is both cooperate, and then if one is screwing the other, then one can get as much as five, and the other can get as little as zero. So here we go along with those rules, never cooperating, and after 1,000 steps, suddenly we start seeing things happening, and you get this wild evolution, which blue always seems to win in this particular case. I mean, by and large, it's very rare that red is above blue, but it oscillates like crazy. Then for a brief moment here, but that moment is actually, you know, many hundreds of iterations, they're both cooperating, but all is not well. They break out of cooperation and start this. Okay, you know, anybody who's seen any of these chaotic dynamical systems has seen pictures like this. It's a genuinely chaotic system in all, with all the usual you know, mathematical stuff that needs that. And the interesting thing is, remember I told you I had to pick these tiny biases. They were one part in a million of these rewards of one, you know, three or one or three. And every time you change those biases randomly, you get completely different evolutionary paths. So you get these zoos of behaviors, you know, where here nobody does anything visible until move 5,000. And then you get this, you know, quasi-periodic stuff that actually doesn't go forever. If I let it go after a while, it would break out of that and do something else. Okay, here's another one. Blue is the score obtained from the blue, by the blue player, and red is the score of the red player. And if there were nothing to break the symmetry, they would be equivalent players. So blue is winning because when there's a choice of moves that are exactly neutral for blue, blue has a 10 to the minus 6 bias direction, which somehow is more favorable than red's 10 to the minus 6 bias direction, even though each of them, if they had a successful strategy, could get to 3, you know, a successful strategy would get to 3-3 and stay there. And every once in a while, you get one. Okay. But I'll tell you, I ran actually thousands of these simulations, and I even then had to write code to detect when if I ever hit one that cooperated. And sure enough, you get they never cooperate. They try cooperating. It's great. They try not cooperating. You know, who knows? Let's not over anthropomorphize a tiny little matrix. But okay, yeah. Yes. Each one takes small steps in their P and Q to evolve. So on a long time scale, not the move by move time scale, but an evolutionary time scale. I should have made that clear. This is not the number of steps in the game. This is the number of times that each has made a slight alteration in the P's and Q's. But the rule is they're dumb, they're evolutionary, they only can sample the local gradient. They don't have any global information. Okay? So over the course of this picture, the little point would move around continuously in the H cube. It adopts that, yeah. But it just keeps taking each of them just keeps taking small steps to climb their own score gradient, and they have no visibility on what score the other player has, or on how the other player's strategy is changing, except that at each stage they're playing against that other strategy. Okay. So you could think of it as one point in eight-dimensional space, or you could think of it as two separate four cubes, and I control the blue four cube, and she controls the red four cube. Actually, she's the blue, and I'm the red. But okay, yeah. What? Because Because that's the way the Markov process works. Because each play is a 1, a 3, or a 5. Actually, a 0, a 1, a 3, or a 5. But the Markov process tells us that for each fixed values of P's and Q's, what the expectation will be, because there'll be some complicated pattern of those integers. So it's the expectation value for the given values of P and Q. Okay, and of course the reason this is so easy to compute is because you can do that, and you don't have to play the individual plays of the game. You can do the Markov magic. Okay, so I wondered, sitting around, whether there were any interior Nash equilibria, because when I simulated this, it certainly never finds them. It just looks always chaotic. Okay, well, you have chaotic because you have strange attractors and, you know, all that stuff that people talk about, but that doesn't exclude the possibility that somewhere in that 8 cube there's some nice basin where they both converge. And you know, I looked in the literature and no one had ever said that that exists, so I thought I would try to find it. And that's just, you know, you'll see why you know, someone who would write a book like Numerical Recipes would waste a Saturday afternoon doing this. It's actually kind of a fun numerical problem, namely simultaneously find two vectors that maximize two different functions of the two vectors, okay? That's not exactly a minimax problem. It's not an optimization problem because there's no one thing that you're maximizing. It's not quite a minimax problem either, but it's something in that sort of family that has Hessian matrices and second derivatives and you know, all that sort of fun stuff that you can think about. And if you just write it out, you know, trivially, it's 8 equations and 8 unknowns, so that means that the solutions should generically be isolated points. So there could just be a Nash equilibrium somewhere in there. And, you know, how hard can it be? The cube is only size 1 by 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 1, okay. And this is, of course, that high dimensions are very unintuitive, and 8, which doesn't even sound very high, is already high enough to have unintuitive things in it. And the answer was, the program kept crashing, okay? And, I mean, when it crashes, you can eventually figure out why, and the reason why is the points were always going to a point where some determinant in the denominator became 0. And they just sort of loved going to those places where the determinant became 0. So I started plotting in 8 dimensions or projections where those points were, and they lay exactly to numerical accuracy on hyperplanes. So this is where the poor dumb numericist says, something must be going on here, and it's not just a simple Nash equilibrium. Well, I was going to a meeting that I knew Freeman Dyson would be at, and it's great to be able to ask Freeman Dyson questions. You know, has Freeman visited here? Good, good. You know, Freeman is, I guess, 89 going on 90. And in my experience, when you ask Freeman a question, he's always polite, he thanks you for the question, he goes off. Most of the time, you never hear a word again about it. But every once in a while, right, as in this case, so here I say, I noticed that they crashed, I ask Freeman. And Freeman came back with an email a day or so after the conference and said, oh, it's really very simple, okay. And it's kind of fun. And it's just, I'm not giving you enough detail here to show the derivation, but you can find it in our paper. It's just high school algebra. It's Cramer's rule applied to 4x4 matrices when you want to find one eigenvalue, okay, which is what you want to do in the Markov case. But what it turns out is if V is the stationary vector of the Markov process, okay, that would be the distribution of scores that reproduces itself under one step of the Markov process, then it turns out that V dotted into any vector that you want F is just a determinant. And here I've written it out, and it depends just on the P's and Q's. And of course, it depends linearly on F because it's a dot product. And I remind you that a determinant is separately linear in each of its columns, so this all makes sense. And the fascinating thing about this is one of the columns depends only on the P's, and another of the columns depends only on the Q's. And that's the special property that these games have that nobody had noticed for 30 years. Okay, and maybe or they did notice and they said, oh, that, I wonder why that is, you know, or what that does. But that is sort of the secret sauce. So for example, to show you why an identity like this is useful, suppose I want to compute S's score. Well, S's score is, okay, so capital S is, S is strategy vector, so that's the essentially the P's. I'm sorry, I'm not saying that right. Okay. I'm momentarily lost, but let's just go forward. Okay. S's score is linear in this vector and is this determinant. Now, what's the how can we use that in a more interesting way? Oops. Yeah. Okay. So this suggests some strategies that we call zero determinant strategies, and let me show you why. So this is the same equation from the previous slide. This is S's score. Okay. But now suppose because it's linear in the things that S controls here, we could instead ask, what is this linear combination of scores for arbitrary alpha, beta, and gamma? Okay. And we would just put in this linear combination of matrices here, and that would be this linear combination. But now here's the trick, because P controls this column. So for any choices of alpha, beta, and gamma, P can look over at this column and just choose a strategy that is the same vector here. And that makes the determinant vanish, because if two columns are identical, the determinant vanishes. But on the other hand, we just decided that this is equal to the linear combination of scores. So what we see is that P can choose a strategy to enforce any linear combination of scores, okay, independent of anything that Y does with the Qs. Now, it's not quite that simple, because this strategy that comes out of this might be unphysical. It might be a probability greater than 1 or less than 0. And so even having gotten that far, you know, I said, oh, okay, anything interesting is going to come out unphysical and there's going to be nothing new here. But no, it turns out that there are some examples that you can just work out by exactly the Freeman-Dyson little determinant paradigm. Okay, so one of these is that if X understands how this works, she can adopt a fixed strategy that exactly sets Y's score between 1 and 3, independent of what Y does. So now imagine Y, this evolutionary bug. Y is evolving in a completely flat space if X leaves the strategy fixed. Okay. But the other thing X could do is X can spoof Y's fitness landscape. Namely, X can observe, this is now not a dumb evolutionary X, this is like a conscious human X, right? Can watch Y's strategy changing and reward or punish it to channel it to any desired outcome. If Y is honestly just evolutionary and trying to go up the gradient. So it's essentially, you're in a space where you think there's a fixed function and you're going up its gradient, but it's not a fixed function. Somebody's looking over your shoulder and faking it to make you think that there's a surface there. Okay, so that's kind of fun. And it suggests some interesting evolution experiments also. Okay, and it turned out someone eventually pointed out to us that this first strategy was known in the literature. But I have to say, it was known in a kind of an offhand way where nobody pointed out that you could actually use this to do the kind of thing I just talked to you about. But I think mathematically, we can't take credit for that. The second one, I think nobody previously noticed. And it's, you can choose a linear combination that sets X's score in excess of the non-cooperative value equal to a multiple greater than 1 of Y's scores greater than the non-cooperative value. And so this is an extortion strategy where chi is the extortion factor. And this says, okay, we'll let Y do whatever he thinks he's doing, but however well he does, we'll do 5 times better than that, and there's nothing he can do about it. And what's the broken, what breaks the symmetry? You know, X and Y could do this to each other. Well, an example of such a strategy, you know, these are not abstract things. In the ends, you can put numbers in and find some P's and Q's. And so here's a strategy. Those are the four values of whether X should cooperate depending on what the value of the previous move was. And this produces a strategy with an extortion factor of 3. Okay, now, if X and Y are both witting of the extortion strategy and try to extort each other, then you'll have 2 such equations as this, but each the other way around, and they'll have only 1 solution, and that solution will be, the scores will both be 1, and they'll never cooperate. Okay, so you can't extort against the extorter, and you both just end up punished for it. But that's sort of not, what should I say, that's the pessimistic view. Let's take an optimistic view, because if they both understand this strategy, then prisoner's dilemma becomes what the game theorists call an ultimatum game. And this is the sort of treaty that you could make in an ultimatum game. So X and Y are now both witting players. They've read Freeman's and my paper, and they say treaty. We will each set the other scores at its maximum value. That's the cooperation value. We'll each get 3. If either detects any deviation from this, then it shall be lawful for them to reduce the other's score, but only by the same amount to make up the deficit that the cheater was trying to do and for the same period of time, after which they will return it to the maximum value. Okay? Now, superficially, this sounds like they're still playing a prisoner's dilemma game, but they're not. There's no advantage in defecting if this treaty is in effect. So this is basically an ultimatum game that says, enforceably, if we agree, we'll both get rewarded, and if we disagree, we won't. And that's kind of fun, because in the game theory literature, prisoner's dilemma and ultimatum are usually considered, you know, antipodal games, just completely different games that lead to completely different behavior. And you see, really, they're not different at all in this respect. So it's not conventional prisoner's dilemma. There's no advantage in defecting. And this really works. Here are 10 different simulations with extortion factor 5. So X is the blue scores, and X is no longer climbing the gradient. X has just put in place the 4 numbers of those ones I showed you before, except that was extortion strategy 3. So there's a different set of 4 numbers, which is extortion strategy 5. And Y is trying to do better and better and does a little bit better and finally ends up here, whereas X ends up. So the distance from here to 1 should be 1/5 the distance of here to 1, if we've done it right. And what's different among the red curves and among the blue curves is, let me just think what. That's kind of interesting. It's Y is trying to climb a gradient. Oh, this is the perfect audience, because you have people here maybe everybody here who knows a little general relativity, okay? What you get to measure is a one form, okay, is a covariant vector. But what you have to decide to change your strategy is a little a contravariant vector, a little motion that you make in the point. And so implicitly, there's a metric between those. And the different curves here are just different random choices of that metric. Now, a way you would explain that to a biologist is you would just say, there are 4 numbers here and they have different mutabilities. So a small change, one person's small change with one set of mutabilities would be a different small change with another set of mutabilities on those 4 numbers. But that's actually a perfectly little geometric thing there. Okay, so can Y escape this extortion? This would be like the pop quiz. So what do you do if you find yourself in a game like this, that however hard you try, the other player's score just mimics yours but is 5 times better? Okay, It depends on whether Y has a theory of mind about X. What's a theory of mind? A theory of mind is, does Y credit X with the ability to change her strategy? Because if he does, then what he should do is he should stop evolving and he should just sit at the non-cooperative value and wait for X to make a deal, right? So roughly speaking, there's a whole literature on theory of mind that the psychologists do. And, you know, there are interesting questions like, at what level of animal, take a bunch of mammals, do they have a theory of mind? I think there's very little doubt that the great apes, the chimps and gorillas, have a theory of mind. There are all kinds of fun experiments that people do with it. But then as you go lower, you know, the dogs have a theory of mind and so on. It's kind of fun to read the psychology literature on that. Okay, so again, this Freeman and I both thought is kind of neat, that there's a game whose outcome depends not on any mathematical strategy, but on whether one player has a theory of mind about the other player. Because in that case, what would happen here is this would go along across with both of them at one until X says, okay, you win, let's make a deal. and then they could, for example, have the treaty that we saw previously. So Josh Plotkin and his postdoc, I think it's Alex Stewart, who were actually referees of our paper, decided to go back and resurrect the code from one of these 30-year-old games where people submitted algorithms and then they played them all against each other. And the interesting thing was, so this is like we were born 30 years too late because we would have come out first with one of these zero determinant strategies here. There are two ways you can decide whether you win the contest. One is by how much you score, and the other is by how often you win. Well, all D means always defect, and that wins all the time. That is to say, at worst it ties, and at best it wins, okay? But it's not a very useful win. And you see always defect is the poorest average score down here. So, you know, this is just our way of sort of tweaking all those famous evolution theorists who wrote that literature 30 years ago, that they really did miss something that once you know about it is obvious and kind of fun and maybe significant. And then the other thing I learned when our paper came out is there are people who are emotional about the prisoner's dilemma game. Like, there's this whole weird community out here, and I'll show you some things they wrote about us, okay? We've shown that, and this is a real guy, he wrote a very nice popular book, Bill Poundstone, on Prisoner's Dilemma. We have shown that cleverness and unfairness triumph after all. Okay, now in this audience, you might enjoy, although it made my skin crawl, once again, physicists invade a field and add value. Okay, I thought, boy, that's not the kind of praise I want to hear. Okay, and then we have, as the agricultural revolution and population growth led to the ability to monopolize social resources, did human cooperation turn from fairness to enforcing the sort of unfair game that Press and Dyson outline? My answer to that is no. And then we get down to whoever Thingambob is who has a blog. This and similar quant nonsense is precisely what led to the too big to fail banking disaster we are currently confronting. These studies are worse than useless. They are a parasitic cancers on society. So, you know, who knew that by setting two columns of a determinant equal to each other, you could become a parasitic cancer on society? But I guess that must be right, you know. Okay. Okay, so now I want to sort of make a little bit of connection to biology, but it's very speculative biology. So real evolution theorists and even real biologists beyond that really do think about fitness landscapes. You have organisms, they can make small mutational changes, they try to optimize, and you imagine that they're on some bumpy landscape, you know, in much higher dimensions than shown, and trying to evolve to the peaks. And in fact, neutral mutation theory, which is a very successful, really not, I wouldn't call it theory, I'd call it a viewpoint, a perspective on evolution, says that almost all the time any organism that you observe is at one of these local maxima because evolution is pretty efficient at having gotten there. But What this little exercise suggests is there's another way to think about this, and that instead of looking like a bumpy landscape, it's more the problem is more simple functions in any dimension, but just lots of them, in a sort of a high, you know, a some huge hypercube kind of thing. And you can ask questions, again, not of real evolution, but of our little game. Okay, so this would be a point of view that says it's the edges that matter, not the interiors. And so if I go back to these simulations, these happen to be exactly the same ones that I showed you before, you can actually get more information out of the computer on this. And here I've plotted, it's a bit of a confusing plot, but I'll tell you what it is. Here are dimensions from 0 to 8 as a function of where we are. And by that I mean, if we're in the interior of the cube, it would be 8. But if we're on an edge, right, there are 7 less dimensions of edge. There are 7 cube edges, 6 cube, you know, this is like going from faces to edges to vertices. But now we have to do it 8 times before we get to points, okay? And the remarkable thing is we're virtually never in the interior of the cube in these evolutions. So things where it looked like nothing was going on, all kinds of things were going on. It's just that our score wasn't changing. All kinds of things were going on that still, in the end, resulted in always not cooperate, okay? Because there are many different choices of P's that lead to essentially non-cooperation here, okay? And this is a little, these are fuzzy because you have to decide with what numerical accuracy are you going to call something being on an edge versus in the interior. Okay. And in fact, it tends to, there are a lot of things that kind of bounce in little scallops off the edge. So that's a little different. Okay. And then the other thing plotted here is it turns out that on some of these, I'm going to call them corners, but actually I mean in any dimension 7 or below, the gradients are actually singular. In other words, the gradient depends on the direction that you come from, and there's a pole there. How can there be a pole? Remember, there was a denominator. There was a determinant in a numerator and a determinant in the denominator, and you can have that. And this is showing over here, but on a logarithmic scale, how close to singular we are. And you see you get these spikes of going closer to singular. And this is just like classical chaos. Those are like scattering off of singularities in chaos, and introduce a lot of the I'm going to say the word, and I mean it more as an analogy, the Lyapunov exponents, the facts that two paths that are very close can suddenly be different because they've scattered very slightly differently off of one of these singular points. And as a little fun exercise, I think I just said that. Yeah, and there's no evolutionary landscape that I've ever been able to detect in the interior. There are no Nash equilibria that I've ever been able to find, although I still haven't proved that. Basically, everything is just kind of smooth. It's just 8-dimensional in the interior. All the action is on the edges. You can kind of, you know, this again looks a little more hobbyist than real science, but you can just work out the combinatorics of how many edges of each dimension are neutral and how many edges of each dimension are singular. And the pop quiz is, why are there 6,560 boundaries? Quick, somebody tell me. In the 8-dimensional cube, why are there 6,560 boundaries? The hint is already on the slide. Oh, come on. Okay, because in each dimension, you can have either 0, 1, or interior. And here I've written it as 0, x, or 1. So it's 3 to the 8th minus 1, because the interior we don't call a boundary. Okay, so 3 to the 8th minus 1 is 6, 5, 6. Okay. So I've probably said most of this. Let's see. The interior gradients are smooth. So evolution usually, if you plop it down in the interior, it just smoothly goes to a boundary. And then it starts just this recursive funny stuff of within that boundary, it goes to another boundary. Within that boundary, it goes to another boundary. What can go wrong to that? It can hit an exactly neutral surface. and then it'll go off in whatever direction that little bias was set for, or it can hit one of these singular surfaces, and then depending on exactly how it comes in, it sees a huge gradient and it goes wham, back into the interior, and the process repeats. Okay, so is there anything in real evolution, in real life, that sort of looks like any of these pictures? The answer is yes. There's something called cryptic genetic variation, okay, or hidden diversity. And here are just four random papers on this. There are not a lot of papers on this, but the idea is the genotype, that is to say the genes, the blueprint, can be changing even if the phenotype, that is what the organism actually is constant, okay? Because there can just be gene networks that don't make any difference because, you know, they're how you would code for some protein if there was some other protein around that would allow it to be coded for. And therefore, that cryptic protein can evolve just randomly by neutral mutation, okay, and make no difference at all until suddenly a different mutation produces the first protein, and now this one matters, and you've sort of jumped in phenotype, okay? The evolution of the genotype was continuous, but the evolution of the phenotype was discontinuous and punctuated. And this is exactly the same idea. This is evolving on neutral boundaries, okay? And it makes a kind of a sense in terms of how gene networks actually work, because although there are, I bet I'm saying what's on a slide. Yeah, let's see. Although you can find examples in biology of carefully buffered things where whole gene networks try to make the concentration of something lie in a certain range, okay? The generic case is a gene is either on or off. You're either on the zero boundary or on the one boundary, okay? And that in turn is going to affect whether other genes are on or off. And to me, that just has very much the same flavor as this little toy game where I started out by trying to understand properties of the interior, and it ended up realizing that the interior has nothing to do with it. It's all just what things are hidden and visible on what boundaries as you sort of zing around on these boundaries. So that's it. Thank you very much.